Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I am your host for the weekend show. Also, your host throughout the week at our website, kereport.com, as well as our podcast, Corlin Economics Report. It was another very busy week for us. Lot of editorials, lot of company updates. So please, everybody who's listening on the radio or who just tunes in on the weekend, take a little bit of time and go back and click on especially some of those company updates, as well as maybe find some of your favorite analysts that I bring on and follow along with them. Also, please, everyone, keep in touch, fleck@kereport.com. I love hearing from each and every one of you. I'm kicking off this weekend show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, it was a busy week this week in terms of news out of the Fed, out of even the U.S. government, and a lot of data that has been trickling out in terms of U.S. economics. And quite frankly, the U.S. economy still is doing pretty well. This rebound seems to be underway, even though we saw the GDP number that was released this week miss estimates. It was still over 6%. Jesse, out of this data, what's been catching your eye?
Well, I'm still just, you know, monitoring a lot of the signs of inflation. You know, we've seen commodities prices just scream higher. And there was a great chart. I can't remember which one of the major brokers put it out, but it's basically just the number of companies on conference calls talking about inflation. And it's just screamed higher this quarter to levels we've literally, never seen before in the 20 years that they've been following this data. So literally companies in all sectors are talking about supply constraints and rising cost pressures. And it's just astounding to me that the Fed is so confident in calling these inflationary pressures transitory when, you know, from everything I look at, inflationary pressures don't show any signs of abating anytime soon.
How long can the Fed, do you think, stay with that narrative of saying this inflation, it is transitory? Because in all fairness, look, last year at this time, the world was a very different place, especially when it comes to the economy. So how long can they use that argument that inflation's transitory?
Well, I think, you know, once we get through these few months where, you know, the quote unquote base effects are really making numbers look, you know, much higher than they otherwise would. You know, if we still have strong inflationary pressures into the fall, then I think the pressure is going to be on the Fed to address it. Now, there's two things, you know, that I really do think that, you know, over the intermediate to long term, are really going to maybe come back and bite the Fed in terms of narratives around policy. And those are, one, the Fed has been exacerbating wealth inequality for a long time now, at least the last, you know, 10 years or so. Now, that is going to create potentially political problems for the Fed in continuing to pursue the extreme experimental monetary policy they've been pursuing since the financial crisis. Now, at the same time, too, the Fed over the last 12 months, you know, through this rethink of policy has said we want inflation to run hot. They've changed their inflation targeting such that they're no longer going to try and cap inflation at 2%, but they want it to average 2%. And that means it needs to be higher than 2% as often as it is lower than 2%. And I think we're already seeing problems with that policy. We're seeing food costs, you know, scream higher, gas costs. And so for people that are out of work or, you know, in the lower income branches, even if they do have a job, you're seeing, incomes have been stagnating, obviously, for 40 plus years now. And now we're seeing that cost of living go screaming higher, not to mention the cost of buying a home. I mean, so many people are being completely just priced out of the market. And, all of these things come back to Fed policy and, are going to be problematic for the Fed at some point.
So it's not just the Fed either. It is also the U.S. government, all governments around the world that are continuing to pump money into the system or into the market. But Jesse, what do you think it'll take to change the Fed's course? If they said they're okay with higher inflation, we're getting higher inflation. A lot of people are saying, well, if a market crash happens, then they're going to be more aggressive. What's it going to take for them to wind back some of this policy?
Well, you know, my friend Bill Fleckenstein has said eventually the bond market will take the printing press away from the Fed. And that's basically, you know, if interest rates start rising, and really, it comes back to inflation. You know, the Fed believes they can always, it's a lot easier for them to battle rising inflation than it is for them to battle deflation. And this is why we've seen this rethink is, you know, the zero lower bound of policy is where the Fed becomes impotent. You lower rates to zero, you buy a bunch of bonds, and that's basically all you can do. And you reach the limits of monetary policy. And so that's why the Fed has said we need to create inflation because we're not comfortable reaching the limits of what we're able to do. And they believe it's a lot easier for them to rein in inflation than to reverse disinflationary trends. And so, I do think at some point, and this is something that I think a lot of people are thinking about right now, is if in the past, the Fed would see these types of inflationary pressures building and would start to get ahead of them by raising interest rates and making sure they don't fall behind the curve of inflation. Now they've decided we're not doing that. We're going to let inflation rise and we're not going to try and head it off. And so what that creates is the potential for inflation to run really hot and the Fed to be way behind the curve. So what then do they have to do in order to rein in inflation if it proves to be not transitory? Well, then the Fed's going to have to go from the zero lower bound to, you know, raising, you know, by 50 basis points several times in a row, to 50, you know, 100, maybe 200, 250, 300 basis points in a short period of time in order to try and rein in inflation. Now, imagine if the Fed went, you know, in a 6-month period from zero to 300 basis points, what that would do to risk assets. It would create a major problem, I think, for the stock market, which has come to expect 0% interest rates forever. So I do think the Fed is playing with fire right now with inflation, and to pretend that they have the confidence that inflation will, you know, prove to be transitory is just a dangerous game.
Jesse, how likely is it, though, in your eyes, that the Fed does provide that big of a shift in policy and goes from zero to, 300 basis points, even 200 basis points in a short period of time? Is that actually going to happen in your eyes?
Yeah, if we start seeing inflation numbers, you know, a year from now, when these base effects are clearly gone and we have inflation running 3%, 4%, 5%, the Fed is going to be forced to do something about that. And because the risk is, and this is really what the Fed has been trying to do, is Paul Volcker was incredibly successful in breaking the inflationary mindset. He convinced not only Americans, but the world that he was going to do whatever it takes to rein in inflation. And he created a lot of credibility for the Fed by he did that. He broke the back of inflation. And then, you know, since that time, everybody's believed the Fed will never let inflation get out of control again. And it's really those inflationary expectations that are more important than inflation because they can be self-fulfilling. So when people start believing that disinflation is the trend, they say, I don't need to buy something today. It might be cheaper, you know, next year, you know, whether that's an iPad or whatever. But when the inflationary mindset changes and people start believing, wait a second, maybe I need to buy something today because, next month, next year, you know, the price is going to be more expensive. That mindset changes as a result of inflationary, you know, people seeing inflation, whether it's in lumber or home prices or anything. That can become self-fulfilling where people say, okay, I need to buy today in order to get ahead of rising prices. I think we're seeing that in the real estate market right now, and that's what's creating such a frenzy in residential real estate. But if you see that type of mindset transition from asset prices to the real economy, that's where the Fed is going to have this problem, where you know, this inflationary mindset has changed. People no longer believe the Fed is going to rein in inflation. We're going to have, let's fill up the gas tank today because tomorrow it'll be more expensive. Let's but you know, buy extra groceries today, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the Fed will have to, you know, will be forced to deal with inflation running 4, 5, 6%.
So then, Jesse, as this all carries over to the markets, look, it's been a good ride for markets, even for commodities. You take a long enough time frame here, especially from the start of the pandemic and that washout, everything's doing well. Obviously, there's a lot more money in the system, but how do you see markets moving forward from here?
Well, you know, the markets, you know, for risk assets, you know, mainly primarily the stock market, is most, I think, you know, attuned to this discussion over asset purchases. And everybody's kind of on pins and needles waiting to see when the Fed is going to start talking about tapering, because we all know that they're going to start talking about it well in advance of doing it. That's something that, you know, Jay Powell has said. You know, Powell was on the FOMC, you know, when they started tapering in 2013, and he was one of the members that was advocating for tapering back then, and he saw what happened with the taper tantrum. And so I think what he has said, you know, is that he's going to address that by giving advance notice, you know, well in advance. So they're going to talk about tapering well before that they're going to do it. They're not going to just say, hey, you know, in the next several months, we're going to start tapering. He's going to say, you know, hey, 9 months from now, six, 9 months from now, we're going to start tapering is probably. And so, you know, I think that the market is waiting to hear that. Like, you know, we've talked about many times, Corey, the stock market is a discounting mechanism. It likes to discount, you know, a year or 18 months into the future. And so, you know, I think that's what the market is doing right now is looking at the Fed and saying, hey, you know, we're probably going to get a rate hike by the end of next year. That's what the markets are pricing in right now, which means we're probably going to get tapering sometime in the next, you know, 12 months or maybe even sooner. You know, they might need to start tapering by the end of this year. And so, you know, if you think about that and kind of walk backwards from that, you know, they need to start talking about tapering here almost any day now to give the markets a good 6 months notice before they start doing it.
How important is it to look around the world, too, and see what other central banks are doing and how other countries' economies are faring during this?
Yeah, you know, I think there is, you know, some lag between, obviously, I mean, you know, a country like India that is seeing case counts just absolutely explode and is not, you know, able to manage, you know, the virus as well as some other places. Yeah, the recovery is going to be staggered, and that's going to make a difference to, you know, investors in those areas. But I do think what the markets are discounting now is that it looks, you know, from the way the vaccine rollout is happening here in the U.S. and even, you know, Israel's kind of probably a good example for the rest of the world, that we are going to get past this. And that's really the optimism in the markets, you know, that's being expressed right now is, you know, it's the inverse of the fear that we saw a year ago when, you know, we were just learning about the virus, markets crashed, everybody's worried it was going to be a major, you know, blow to the economy. And it turns out, you know, we did have a V recovery in the economy and in earnings. And so, you know, I think that's probably what markets are pricing in around the world.
So when it comes to investing then, Jesse, look, like I think you are right in the sense that fear has left the markets, and as COVID gets a little bit more under control and people are maybe more optimistic, and will we see that reflected in the markets plus spending habits of individuals? But in terms of investing right now, it's impossible to tell somebody to go out and short these markets because they would have just been run over this last year. But where do you stand in terms of finding some investments and some opportunities out there?
First of all, I have to disagree with you. I think the markets have been a great place for shorting over the last few months. You just have to be very tactical. And to me, you know, you look at all these stay-at-home stocks, you know, that did so well. These have been great shorts over the past few months, whether it's Zoom or Peloton or any. I mean, you know, the ARK Innovation Fund has been, you know, a wonderful thing to try and trade from the short side. More recently, you know, small caps have gone nowhere since February. I think that's an area where we can look to be tactically short, because small caps are just obscenely overvalued right now. If you think about, you know, what has benefited most from the reopening trade, it's been small caps. And I do think probably what we're looking at going forward is not just inflation, but stagflation. You listen to all these companies that are talking about supply constraints, and they're also, you know, I mean, all the automakers are shutting down production. So their costs are going up and they can't produce vehicles. And so that is not great for the economy. It's not great for their earnings. And they're just, you know, probably the prime example of a trend that's happening to a lot of companies right now. And so I do think there are opportunities on the short side. But to me, you know, inflation is here. The numbers are going to start reflecting it in the next few months. And to me, I don't think, when I'm doing a lot of this research, I keep coming back to the conclusion, I can't own enough gold right now. That it's so out of favor right now. And with inflation picking up, there's no way that Jay Powell is going to be able to allow the long end of the curve to keep up with inflation over the next few months. And I don't think it probably would anyways. But, you know, we're looking at, you know, 1.5% on the 10-year, 2.25% on the 30-year treasury. If inflation is going to go 3%, 4%, or 5% over the next, you know, few months and couple of quarters, you know, that's going to mean that 30-year yield is significantly negative in real terms, which is incredibly bullish for the gold price. And, you know, to me, gold has had a very healthy correction since last summer. We're entering into the seasonally strong period of the year for gold prices. It's out of favor. We've seen massive outflows out of gold ETFs. Just as all of these fundamentals are lining up for, you know, to push the price higher, I think we could see gold scream higher over the next few months.
Now, is that going to go in the face of other commodities that maybe need a pullback or a broad market pullback? How does that happen in a big picture sense here, looking at some of the other sectors?
I do think we're probably very close to a pullback in the equity markets. Probably all of these reopening trades are a little overheated, overdone right now. So even commodities probably could pull back some. But, you know, I hesitate to say that because I do believe we are the early stages of a commodity super cycle, but that doesn't mean there can't be, you know, significant corrections, you know, and pullbacks. We could be near one of those for the commodity markets right now. It just seems like so many people have bought into this idea of a commodity super cycle. Bullishness towards, you know, copper and a lot of other things has you know, gotten pretty extreme. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all to see a pullback in these things. But, you know, like I said, I do think we're not just looking at inflation, but we're looking at a stagflationary period. You know, after the base effects for GDP wear off, you know, we're going to fall back to, you know, 2-3% GDP growth at best, you know, going forward. And if you have, you know, inflation running significantly higher than that, I mean, it's negative growth in real terms. That's not, you know, a healthy situation. And you know, markets, probably stagflation is the worst environment to own financial assets like stocks and bonds. And it's probably one of the best environments you can imagine for precious metals. And so I do think that's probably where we're headed. And if so, if you get stagflation with some form of yield curve control or something like that, I mean, that is an incredibly bullish setup for the gold price. And it's just so ironic to me that gold is so out of favor right now when the setup for it, the fundamental, you know, setup going forward has rarely been as bullish as it is today.
Oh, and even after this 7+ month correction here, gold is still at a much higher level than it was for almost the last decade, or most of the last decade at least. Now, Jesse, I know that you follow a lot of the gold producers, the major gold miners. Is that where you're going to be focused, or are you looking in other sectors within the gold sector for investments?
You know, mainly, I like to own the metal directly for the majority of my position. I use the miners as kind of trading vehicles. And I just feel like right now, a lot of the research I'm doing, I just come to the conclusion I don't own enough of the precious metal directly in my portfolio. So yeah, I think it used to be the Central Fund of Canada. It's now the Sprott Physical Gold and Silver ETF. That thing trades, it's been trading at 5-6% discount to its net asset value for the last few months, which to me, if you can buy the metals at a 5% discount, that's a pretty nice bargain, especially when I think fair value for the gold price is, well above the current level.
All right, Jesse, we'll wrap it up there. Always great having you on the show, buddy. I enjoy reading over everything you publish out of the Felder Report, and I always appreciate you taking some time and sharing all of your thoughts with our listeners. Have a great rest of your weekend, Jesse. We'll chat again in another few weeks.
Thanks, Corey.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Jesse Felder. I am now switching focus a little bit more to the resources, and in this segment, the precious metals, as I am chatting with Richard Postma, aka Doc. Now, Doc, let's just quickly recap the month of April for the precious metals. You and I are recording this about halfway through the day on Thursday, so we don't know the close at the end of April, but I think we can both confidently say that gold and silver will close this month higher. Now, that is after a pretty consistent sell-off month after month. I realize that gold was due for a higher close. The last time we had a higher monthly close was back in December. But one of the arguments being for gold is that it still hasn't taken out the downtrend channel that it's in. And quite frankly, it is still below a couple longer-term moving averages, like the 200-day moving average. Doc, what's your takeaway from gold's action in April and how that leads into May?
Well, every once in a while, a dog has its day, and we have to have an up month. And we had, when this all started, we had about four down months, and then we had an up month in December. And then we had three more months down as far as closing lows, I'm talking about. And now we're going to have a closing high. So that's a good thing. But it doesn't tell you much. We're still in that monthly channel, which I've been watching for months. And now going forward, as far as May is concerned, of course, we have three possibilities. We get a nice reversal and gold really screams higher, which I think is the odds of that are less than 5% by looking at the monthly chart. The other possibility is that we move a little bit sideways yet, and it's a 9+ month for May, which is another possibility. And that's a real possibility, by the way, Corey. Or we have, we move down again to test the lows of April. And we have a little bit of a heavier down month. Those are the possibilities. Now, if we trade a little sideways, like we did in March on the 12-month moving average on the MACD. If we do that again, we're going to probably be in the range of April. But then June could be a very difficult month if we see that happens. So I'd rather see a down month next month, and then a little bit more in June, and then maybe we get a break from this for a while. But that's what I see, Corey. But I don't see us taking out the downtrend line on that monthly chart at all.
So, Doc, what are some of the levels that you're going to be watching when it comes to a gradual or general pullback for next month, or even if it bleeds into June?
If we can stay in the area of 1,700 to 1,800 for May, it'll be an accomplishment as far as I'm concerned.
Doesn't that take out the downtrend line then? If it does hang around that 1,800 for a couple more weeks, that downtrend line is right around 1,800 right now.
Well, not on the monthly chart, it isn't. And so we're okay there. We're stuck in the middle right now on the monthly chart, on the upper downtrend. But the lower downtrend line, if you do it as a parabola, then we're okay yet. But so you want to stay within 1,700 to 1,800. But that worries me a little bit, because then June could get kind of ugly. I would rather see us move down a little bit more and not have June as ugly, because here's the key, and I've been saying this right along, Corey. We gotta work this move down on the monthly charts where we can get a sustained movement back up. And we're not going to get a sustained movement back up if we start to turn up here, because we could have play out what happened way back in 2011 and 12, where we double top, and I don't want to see that at all. I'd rather keep moving down and consolidating and then wait for the next big move up, because if we double top and then we come down, it's going to be ugly for a long time.
So, Doc, I understand that last year, 2020, gold went on a crazy run, especially in the first half of the year, and now we're working off some of those excesses, but it's already been 7-8 months, and that's about as long as that big run to kick off last year lasted. Now, I realize 2019 gold was running higher too, but that was a bit more of a gradual rise. So when is enough enough then?
Well, I'm afraid it's going to get the bulls pretty depressed for a while. I hate to say that. And I think we're going to have to be very patient here. But like I've always said, by being patient, you're going to get some really fine buying opportunities here. And some stocks have come off to where they were, and they're decent companies and they have good management. So there are going to be opportunities, because if you take your time to purchase these and take your positions wisely, I think the next move could be the one we've all been waiting for, where it's really going to be a massive move. And I think that's going to be because of the money printing and the inflation we're going to ultimately experience. It's going to take time to work itself through the system. But with the way they're printing money now and some of the numbers we're seeing with CPI and others, I think it's on its way.
So, Doc, in your eyes, and there's a number of different reasons and arguments for this, but why do you think commodities broadly are running, but the precious metals are getting left behind?
Because, I think some of it's weather issues, it looks like. It looks like it's going to be a lousy planting season for the farmers as far as agriculturally. And the other one is a supply line issue, which may be worked out if we ever get done with this COVID thing, where we start to see the global economy opening up. So I think that's the reason you're starting to see a lot of this right now, Corey. And as we're aware, certain mines have been shut down, they will be reopening as far as some of these commodities are concerned with. But right now, the CRB is looking real good. And it's going to continue, I think, for a little while as well. Copper has just been phenomenal. And I regret selling one of my companies, which is going even higher, but I hold other copper companies as well. But I think we're coming to a point here on the monthly chart on the CRB where it's going to have to decide whether it continues its move higher or whether we topped out here for a while and it starts to move sideways to down a little bit for a while. And we're getting close right now.
Doc, what about silver? Because silver, it held up and it is still holding up better than gold when you look at the last about 7 to 8 months. However, the argument was silver was really benefiting from this rise in base metal. Silver has that industrial use and that was helping support it. I've noticed in the last, let's say, month, maybe two, that as base metals have run higher, silver has kind of been left behind now. Where does silver fit into this picture?
Silver is really struggling here, Corey, and I still feel that we have one more leg down in silver. I don't like what I'm seeing on the 200-day moving average on silver chart. It's starting to move almost sideways, and that's a real warning. It doesn't have a nice trajectory up anymore, and we've been sitting right on that thing. And I think I'm very uncomfortable with silver, and I think we have more move down in silver yet. And I still think the odds are very good that we see about $23 on silver, and hopefully that's low. If we get there and it stabilizes, then I think the worst is over for silver.
So overall then, Doc, when it comes to these stocks, it sounds like you are not being aggressive and maybe holding a lot of your cash, waiting for generally lower levels, especially with your outlook that lower precious metals prices will be here for at least another month.
Yeah, I didn't buy anything the last week or so. I was tempted, but the reason I wait, Corey, is I want to see how the month of May starts out. That'll give me a good idea on how these, as far as for gold, on the gold chart technically. And that'll be a good indicator of whether I want to get a little bit more aggressive in my purchases. I'm up to about 40% now. And I've said in the past I was 37. So I'm slowly starting to take very select positions. And they're in companies that have had most of their sell-off, which I'm very comfortable with. And I know there's not much downside pressure on a lot of them. So I'm starting to buy those. And I'm waiting for about three or four of them again to correct lower here. And I'll be purchasing more. But I'll get probably more aggressive in May and June. It all depends on when the calendar turns, how that monthly chart looks to me when we first start out the first week in May.
So, Doc, last question. Are you focusing on majors, mid-tiers, juniors? Where are you watching for that drop to put your money to work?
I'm doing it in every mid-tier, large cap, and on juniors, depending on what the charts look like and whether I feel most of the selling has taken place. So I'm being very non-discriminatory right now in my purchases. And I plan on continuing that, Corey, as long as the companies I'm purchasing look to me to be very favorable as regards a number of variables.
What are some of the key variables then?
Well, it's always number one, management. Number two, cash on hand. Number three, the fact that their number of shares outstanding aren't in the stratosphere. The grade of their particular product as far as gold and silver, there's a number of them like that I look at. And then I do my own little formula where I tell myself whether it's time to buy or not.
Okay. Hey, Doc, appreciate your time this weekend. Again, it's been a good month for the precious metals. Commodities broadly, again, very good. But it sounds like you still have some more words of caution for investors in the precious metals. I know you're getting under the skin of some of those gold bugs, Doc. But in all fairness, you have been pretty spot on with your calls. Just simply looking at these charts, especially the long-term charts. Doc, thank you again for your time. Have a great rest of your weekend.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.
providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are shifting our focus a little bit more back into the resource sector, but outside of just the precious metals. We are chatting with Doc Jones. He's becoming pretty well known on our website, also well known on a lot of the resource blogs out there as Dr. Jones because of, well, his articles and his insights into different companies that he likes, and also breaking down some of the factors within different resource sectors that he thinks are either being overlooked or completely mistold to the market. Doc, we're going to start off with battery metals, more specifically nickel. Look, in the last couple of years, battery metals have really come back onto the radar, and that was after a period of time there where people weren't paying a whole lot of attention. But again, this is really the second run from what I can remember in the last maybe 5 or 6 years that battery metals have had all around this whole green initiative and the building out of new battery technologies. When it comes to nickel, that has been doing very well, still in an uptrend, what's your research shown you about the nickel market and where it could go here fundamentally?
Oh, hi, Corey. Thanks for having me back. It's interesting. You know, I think investors really need to be careful of just buying into the latest trend unless you really understand the industry. For example, nickel, there is lots of talk about shortages of class one nickel and prices were going to go sky high. But if you look back about 6 weeks ago, nickel had its largest 2-day drop in history. It dropped 22% in price. And the reason for that is Tangshan Holdings in China, they have these large pig iron nickel mines in Indonesia, but they also have a process in which they can convert that into class one nickel. And they've been doing that for years, but on a small scale, just when they needed to. But now, because nickel prices are favorable and there's a lot of demand for class one, they're expanding that capability. And therefore, that means that the market will be well supplied. Anytime there's not enough, it will produce more and capture the extra margin on doing that. So there'll be a floor on the nickel, but there'll also be a ceiling on the price because of that. So a lot of people, I see investors, they've dived into names that just have nickel in it, or they see a 2-meter intercept of 1% nickel, and they throw all their money into it without completely understanding. And what that means also is that it's less likely someone's going to build an underground mine for nickel sulfide, unless it's really huge and of a great grade, because they can convert, you know, pig iron nickel from an open pit into class one. So that's kind of the dark side of investing in resources. If you don't know the sector, if you don't understand what you're investing in, then don't. You really should have a working knowledge of it, and you'll avoid disappointment that way. And as far as within the battery metals, there's a lot of things going on. Like, the chemistry has not been set. So if you take, for instance, people are piling in the graphite, but they're also looking at replacing graphite with silicon. There's that going on. There's also, they're engineering out cobalt using a, a high magnesium battery. Magnesium, there'll be nickel in it, but even less nickel too, right? So that means less nickel, zero cobalt. So if you take away the future demand for cobalt in batteries, what are you left with? You're left with a cobalt price that's substantially lower. There's all those things, as well as, you know, you look at for grid storage, for example, they're engineering out the use of lithium in grid storage batteries for large capacity ones, where one of the possible chemistries is the zinc ion battery, which is a hell of a lot cheaper, charges faster, has a greater energy density. So the jury is still out, so to speak, on which of these battery metals are going to be the winners. So one should be very careful when investing. The only one that I know for sure that it's going to do well is copper, because, you know, as far as transporting electricity from point A to point B, you know, it's going to be copper. You're not going to use aluminum. You're not going to use silver. Those are much too expensive. So, you know, on the periodic table, copper is the clear winner.
It's one of those where all roads seem to lead back to copper, isn't it? Because battery metals, they are smaller markets, and yeah, they can go on these runs, but again, everyone needs copper to build out this infrastructure. Now, Doc Jones, does that mean that you're staying away from the battery metals sector? Is there still a couple select companies that have your attention?
Yeah, I'm pretty much staying away from it. I get my battery metal exposure through, the industrial metals, copper, zinc, lead. So that's how I'm playing it there. I'm not specifically in like a graphite or a lithium play, with those type of opaque markets for graphite and lithium, cobalt, unless a company has an offtake agreement and has a really large deposit as well as the financial capabilities to prove to the end consumer out there of whatever product they're producing that they will be around for years, that they can get the mine up and running, nothing's going to happen to that deposit. So yeah, that's how I'm getting my exposure that way. I'm also playing the battery metals through the opposite with investments in oil and gas, because for one thing, baseload power, nuclear still is not getting the traction that we all would hope that it would. Like recently, this report came out that production's falling in the U.S. again, and once things are reopened, the demand is going to be insatiable. So I'm looking at markets that have a built-in supply deficit on the horizon. So that would be oil, copper, zinc. Yeah, so those are my primary ones, and silver as well. I get silver exposure through polymetallic miners that also gets me my green energy exposure that way.
Okay. Hey, that all makes sense. Taking some of these other metals that, in all fairness, also have a lot more uses than just in the battery and electrification world or movement that we're going through. Let's talk about some of those base metals then. Copper and zinc. You've already outlined why you like copper. What about zinc? What's your research shown you about any of the maybe supply or demand imbalances upcoming?
Well, if you look at zinc on the supply side, there hasn't been any new zinc mines come on in the last decade of size that's going to be able to handle the demand that is rising right now. Zinc prices have exceeded a 3-year high, as well. Even without the possible green energy demand, the galvanizing sector. We have iron ore prices at historic highs, steel production in China way up. We're coming out of a prolonged, protracted period of low to negative economic growth. The amount of stimulus and infrastructure spending that's going to be going on, we've got a minimum of 2 consecutive years of booming GDP growth, which is directly related to infrastructure spending, construction, all those things. You've got lumber. An all-time high. It's up, 300% in the last 2 years. All these things, and zinc also goes into a lot of other things besides galvanizing, rubber, brass, paints, all these things that will be needed for construction, either residential or commercial, as well as infrastructure. So that's what I really love about zinc. And it's also, it's a market that most people don't really think about. Your retail investors are generally concerned with gold and silver, right? Maybe copper. But these other industrial metals are very important, and you can make a lot of money with them. So that's what I like about the zinc market. And if you find a nice polymetallic producer or explorer that is going to be producing copper, zinc, lead, silver, maybe gold, you get all of them. You get them all at like one-stop shopping, so to speak. Yeah, so I think that's where investors need to look, especially right now, because the jury's still out on gold as well. I think gold is stabilized, and I don't think we won't see below $1,500 an ounce. But I do think it'll be challenged to be above $2,000 in the next year. A year from now, I think gold will start to ramp up. But in a lot of cases, I think it's going to be dead money unless there's company-specific news flow. Myself, with gold, for example, I've only recently started to invest again after being out of that market for 6 months, putting all my investments on hold. And the only investment I made was with Tracci Gold, who you've had on your show. And that's primarily because they have a path to production and cash flow 8 months from now when they start processing tailings. So there will be cash flow. And once that cash flow comes, you can apply a multiple to it. And the market will do that, and that will create a floor for the stock as well as a great amount of appreciation when it reprices to its peers. You know, I'm looking at, you know, 2 to 4x just from that. And then you've got the exploration upside. So you get both things within the one company versus just an explorer, which I've seen. Like, I have a watch list of 200-300 companies, and I see explorers. They make a great discovery hole. The stock shoots up 40%, 50%, and within 2 weeks, it's down 30-40% from that. You know, the market's just not holding the gains when it comes to the gold explorers at this point.
So then, Doc, when you're looking at some of these base metal plays like copper and zinc plays, do you tend to stick with some of the bigger players then, or are you still diving down into some of these explorers or juniors, even though, let's face it, M&A has been painfully slow in these areas?
It's been a bit of both. You know, initially I'm starting to move into the explorers, but, you know, if you just look at the empirical data, you know, for example, look at the charts. If you look at Capstone, Freeport-McMoRan, Glencore, you know, all these big companies that go, I'll never own, I'm only going to make 20% or something in a year. These companies are up 500 to 1,000% in the last year, year and a half. All these producers, right? And they hold their gains, right? And they're making a lot of money, and they're not diluting, and there's no exploration risk because they already have the reserves, they're already in production, they're generating cash flow. Like, for example, Capstone just came out with their earnings. They paid off all their debt, the debt's free. They're generating millions and millions of dollars, right? The stock has gone from like 40, 50 cents a year ago to over $5 now, I believe, you know? And that's a boring ride, right? Retail investors, they want that thrill that, you know, make 10x in 2 weeks. And it rarely happens. That really, rarely happens. The best money that has been made in the last year, 2 years consistently has been in these larger cap companies that have a defined asset, the resource, the mill, the production. And as the prices rise, which we saw with the gold producers last year, their margins expand more rapidly than the price appreciation in gold. It's the same story. But we're at a point that I think it's time to look at those explorers, the polymetallic explorers, because people will see those shortages coming, and they have been ignored for so long that you can basically buy them for 3 or 4 cents on the dollar, you know, as far as the resource, or even less in some cases, that have a mineable resource, not just the resource, a mineable resource, right? My most recent investment was in Amerita Resources. It's EMO on the TSXV. I did a lot of research on them. I talked to the CEO, and as I say to people listening out there, retail investor, call the company, email them, ask to speak to someone there, the CEO or the CFO, and talk to them, ask them questions, learn things. You know, through my conversation, I learned a lot more about the company than I knew just going through CEDAR and all these other things. And that led me to something else where I was able to deduce that, you know, this company has been tied up in a legal battle for 5 or 6 years. It's been dead money. One of them was resolved recently, after which 3 hours later, Eric Sprott bought 10% of the company. And then the other legal battle is going to come to the conclusion in June, where they've been in court for 5 years. And right now, so far, 5 Supreme Court judges unanimously has sided with them. So it looks like they're going to get it. And the value of that is that there's two past producing mines on that land package, which, as far as just the underground resource that is mineable, comes out to 63 million tons at a metal value of $17 billion at an average $275 a ton, which is very economic to mine. Which is and within that, you've got over 200 million ounces of silver, over 1 million ounces of gold, billions of pounds of zinc, billions of pounds of copper and lead. Now, granted, you know, it's $17 billion in metal value, right? You're not going to get 100% recovery. But even if you give it a discount because, you know, the recovery factors vary, let's say you knock off 40%, okay, that $17 million comes $10 billion, right? So you've got a company that's got $10 billion in mineable, recoverable resource, trading at a $50 million market cap. And that's just the one land package. The other land package, which they do have title to, that they won, that brought Eric Sprott in, that land package too has a mineable resource of over $4 billion in metal value, which they are expanding. That both these properties have not been drilled in over 20 years. And the mineralization comes right at surface, so it means no sinking of a shaft, which means you don't have to fork out hundreds of millions of dollars and have a two-year lag time before you get your first cash flow from it. And it's just incredible. And that property itself, you know, they've got about 22 million tons so far at an average of over $400 a ton. But it's not sexy like a gold mine. But if you convert things into gold equivalent, which I do for people in my research report, so that people get a concept, for the one property, that's like having a 10 million ounce mine at something like 5 grams a ton, right? An underground mine, 5 grams a ton, 10 million ounces of gold equivalent. The other one, it's about about 3 million ounces gold equivalent at about over 6 grams a ton. Very economic and unknown and uncovered because they've been in legal battles for 5 years and they were left for dead. Now, granted, the stock has woken up because I put up the research reports on it. And the last few days, I think it's up 30-40%, something like that. So it's at a $50 million market cap. But between those two properties, you add it up, you're looking at like a $23, $24 billion in underground mining resource. It's crazy, but it's out there. You just have to look for it.
Yeah, you just have to do the due diligence, right, Doc Jones? And that's one thing that, hey, I've been very impressed with your due diligence so far. And one thing to note, I have also posted those three reports that you published on Emeritus Resources so that everybody can read over those. You just need to visit our website, kereport.com, and read over those company reports. Doc Jones, we're going to wrap it up here. Great having you back on the show. Thanks for sharing some of your insights in the battery metals and some of the base metals. Everybody, thank you for tuning in for this first hour. The second hour, a special second hour, as it is a replay of the Royalty Roundtable that I recorded and hosted on this Wednesday. So anyone that missed out on that, you can, hear most of the highlights in the second hour. And again, that full replay posted on our website this weekend. Doc Jones, thanks for your time. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Oh, thank you, Corey. It was a pleasure talking to you again. Take care.